This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. And tonight, Jamf Software are back to sponsor the show. Jamf make the great Casper Suite MDM service for Macs and iOS devices, and we'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. Bradley, good evening.
How's it going?
It's going pretty well. How are you?
I am amazed by Google Drive today.
What's happened?
Incredible price cut.
Okay.
So you can now get a 100 gigabyte account for $2 a month, or you can get a terabyte account for $9 or $9.99 a month.
That is quite surprising.
Yeah, and especially if you compare it to Dropbox's pricing, it's $100 for 100 gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, photos are obviously kind of my hobby in terms of, like, you know, just what people know me for. And I dropped some photos into Google Drive. I had not tested it a whole lot for photos, just because I know a lot of people have some aversion to storing massive amounts of data with Google.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, their photo viewer on the mobile apps is incredible.
Mm. It's probably worth a look then, eh?
Yes, I will probably have to upgrade my account to at least 100 gig.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think the mobile app doesn't have a kind of like auto-upload feature like Dropbox, so does it?
I don't think so. But
is that part of the Google Plus app?
It is part of the Google Plus app,
okay.
But you can also use the app I've mentioned in my book called Camera Sync. Mm-hmm. It does support uploading good to Google Drive, and it's location-based. So you could set it to when you get home, upload your camera roll to Google Drive.
That's quite interesting. Yep. I'm certainly starting to see more things that used to just be Dropbox-based are also in a Dropbox and Google Drive capable as well. So I think it seems to be... It's definitely coming on pretty strong as a competitor to Dropbox. I mean, we've obviously talked about this before in the context of, you know, using Google Apps for the school and, you know, getting the value out of that there. And I think these same pricing tiers apply if you're a Google Apps customer as well. I think it's just across the board, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Of course, we do get more storage for free, I believe. I think I have 30 gigs in my Google Apps for Education account. So it's obviously, I think regular accounts get 15 gigs for free.
Yeah.
I would almost like to see them add a tier at 250 gigs. You know, it's 100 gigs straight to a terabyte is a big jump. So maybe like a 250 for $5 a month plan, something like that.
But that's, yeah, possibly.
Again, these are complete first world problems.
Well, I think it's interesting to speculate. I mean, I've been involved in things where we talked about, you know, building storage provision for school children and things like that, and how much could we procure it for, and how much could we build it for, and how much should we just shovel money at one of these companies. And if you think about how much data a school child would generate over the course of their whole school career, you know, I'm hard-pressed to see it getting over 100 gigabytes. So if you imagine that you could, for what would that be... I mean, Scotland is 13 years worth of schooling until you leave for university. So you're talking about, what, 318, is that right? Something dollars for 100 gigabyte quota all the way through your entire school career, $300 total school lifetime price. I don't know that you could put an on-site server with that kind of quota for that kind of money when you add up all the full cost of ownership of that versus something in the cloud.
And you could probably get by for a few years just on the free tier. And that doesn't even count the fact, you know, if you deployed a server today, you would probably have to redeploy that server 2 to 3 to 4 possibly times over their school span.
Yep. Yep. So you got to factor that in as well. The time taken to procure, the time taken to decommission, migrate, all that stuff as well.
Backup.
Absolutely. On-site and off-site, the whole bit. So very, very interesting and extremely aggressive move as well. And you know, I mentioned it on Twitter and somebody said to me, you know, well, Apple better sharpen up on that. But I don't think it's really Apple that they're looking at there. Really feels like a very aggressive move against Dropbox there.
Yeah, Apple's not, they're not competing in this game. The biggest thing we use the iCloud backups for are photo backups to your camera roll and iCloud backup. But, you know, when you look at Dropbox's pricing for 100 gig, Google Drive is 75% cheaper. But I think what this comes down to for Dropbox is, you know, for all the benefits of using Amazon S3 as a startup, mm-hmm. you're not able to cut your cost as you go, because you're buying a data center space, I guess, somewhere between retail and wholesale. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to say specifically retail, but Google obviously has their own infrastructure, so as they see cost efficiencies, they can cut the price. And again, that's not their bread and butter. They want you using their services. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, if Amazon S3 is able to cut cost slightly, well, does Dropbox pass that on to its customers, or do they take that as an extra revenue opportunity to save some additional space? And certainly Dropbox, as they go, their hosting has got to get more expensive because as they store more data. So, you know, there's a benefit to owning your own technology.
Yeah, and I think at some level as well, the thing that is really in a bit of trouble here is Dropbox for Teams, which is really expensive. When you look at it, that's the only way you can even get a terabyte account on Dropbox is to go for Dropbox for Business. It's pretty expensive. So it'll be interesting to see exactly how that all shakes out. I'm just trying to pull up the Dropbox for Teams pricing here.
I want to say it's $7.95 a year for four people. I'm guessing that's what I'm going on memory. And I think it's an additional, that includes a terabyte, but then there's an additional $125 fee per person, which is frustrating because you'd like to just say, look, we want to buy a terabyte of space. And then they'd try to nickel and dime you to add each additional user. And, you know, I think they do give you more storage, but you probably don't need more storage. I mean, maybe what you need is a terabyte with 10 users.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm looking at it just right now, and they've got here $15 per user per month, minimum 5 users. So it's $70 per month minimum for however much that is. Let's actually see here.
It's $840 a year. So 70 times 12 is 840. And that, so, yeah, it's not cheap. And the thing is, Dropbox has not ever – I don't remember them lowering their prices at all. And I don't think the necessary – maybe they don't have to lower their prices – but I think they would do wise to maybe ditch the 100 gig. Mm-hmm. Maybe the 200 gig is $99, or maybe it's a 250 gig for $99.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's, you know, it'll be interesting to see if they even pay attention to it.
What I think is also interesting with Google Drive is that there are some parts of that that don't count towards your quota at all. So if you use Google Docs and Google Sheets, none of that counts towards your quota. And if you upload photos, I think it's only like really high res photos, like over 2048 pixels. Smaller pictures than that don't count towards your quota either. So there's a lot of extras for free there as well. I mean, even add up, you know, how much is a pretty good web based office suite worth? I mean, that's, you know, that's not nothing either.
Well, and don't forget, in Dropbox, shared files count against both quotas, where in Google Drive, it only counts against the person that's sharing it.
Yeah, they've been taking a trick out of the American phone carriers. I think they're
charging
for SMS on both ends. Yeah,
It's, you know, and that's always been frustrating to people. It's like, well, I don't want that, and so, well, you have to leave the shared folder or something. So,
yeah,
this will be an interesting battle to watch because for so long I considered Dropbox kind of stands alone by itself here, mm-hmm. and then you've got things like Transporter that are completely doing a different roundabout, and then Google Drive comes in and makes 100 gigs for $25 a year.
Google Drive are just doing a full frontal attack there, and Transporter trying to do a runaround.
So interesting. That'll be a fun one to watch in the days to come.
Good time to be Dropbox.
Yeah.
Glad I don't have their problems. So, anything else going on?
Not really. Don't think so.
I guess we're just waiting for the next app announcement.
iOS 7.1.
Of course, 7.1. Yeah. At last. Finally.
Yes.
There is actually something interesting. There's lots of interesting things about iOS 7.1, but one of the things that is not very obviously known is that with iOS 7.1 and the latest Apple TV firmware, Apple TVs can now be discovered over Bluetooth LE rather than Bonjour broadcast on your network. This is a really big deal. If the devices that you want to connect to Apple TVs and the Apple TVs themselves are on different subnets in your school. So how it works is not every device that can AirPlay, but the ones that have Bluetooth 4, I think it is, can talk to Apple TVs that have got Bluetooth in them, and they can discover each other over Bluetooth proximity first. And then the actual AirPlay traffic does go over the network. So as long as you can route between the two VLANs, you can AirPlay across a subnet boundary. Now, that's a really big deal. I haven't tested it yet. I haven't reconfigured my network, but I hear that works, and I think that's going to be a pretty big deal for people with a lot of different VLANs.
Well, yeah, and I think we may have talked about this on a previous show, that these are the kind of things that Apple needs to do if it really wants the Apple TV to be kind of an accessory to an iOS deployment, where forever, if you have a classroom with 25 kids and you want every one of those to have an Apple TV, these are the kind of things they have to do. Because certainly in bigger environments, you've got to have these kind of tools.
Yeah, and I think, I suppose also, I haven't really thought about this in great detail, but I suppose if the discovery now happens over Bluetooth, then whatever place you are in the school, you're only going to see one or at most possibly two Apple TVs in your proximity, right? Because you're not going to see one on the other side of the campus over Bluetooth because the range is just not there.
Yeah, obviously there are ways to block Bonjour completely over your network. So if you like on your guest network, you don't want to show the Apple TVs, that there's obviously ways to do that. But this kind of takes care of that problem. Well, what if it's in another classroom? You know, if you don't set it up with a passcode, what if they AirPlay to me accidentally? And it's really a smart move by Apple.
Yeah, I think it is. I suppose it shows a bit of foresight, because the Bluetooth radio went into the Apple TV a while back. And then the first thing that you could do with it was you could connect an actual Bluetooth keyboard to your Apple TV for data entry, and now this feature as well, you know. So it's starting to pay some dividends, which is quite interesting.
And I'll be updating our iPads to 7.1 probably this week. I was waiting on the configurator update, and that did drop. It was 1.5, mm-hmm. And so I'll probably start making the move to 7.1 very soon.
Yeah, I just saw that as I opened up my laptop to record the show, and I noticed that one of the new features in Configurator 1.5 is integration with Brentford carts.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually show like battery and charging status on a Brentford cart right inside Configurator. I don't have one of those $10,000 carts, so I can't test it. But I just saw that in the notes. I thought it was an interesting little move.
Yes, yes. Before we move on, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor for this week. The fine folks at Jamf Software are back once again sponsoring Out of School. They provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in education organizations. Now with Casper Focus, they have placed these great technologies directly into the hands of teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app. They can select specific Apple TVs assigned to the class. They can choose and distribute iBooks, and they can even initiate AirPlay right from Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. We'll have a link to their website in our show notes at outofschool.net or in your favorite podcasting app. So if you're looking for an MDM and you want to support Out of School, give Jamf a go and let them know that you heard about them on our show. Thanks for Jamf Software for sponsoring our show this week.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back. Good to have them back.
Yes, yes, it is.
Definitely.
Nice folks too. They're dealing with them offline with sponsor information and copy reads. They're really nice people, and it's always nice to deal with companies who their employees are just nice. You know, I've always been impressed with my SE at Arrowhive. They're just regular people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always nice to see the people behind the company.
Yeah, well, that's Minnesota for you, isn't it? Minnesota, nice. I'm not going to try and do the accent from Fargo. It's one of my favorite movies.
We'll make that a ringtone.
Yeah, me doing the Coach Z accent, yeah. Okay, so this is week 5, Bradley, of our Deploy series. What's the topic for tonight?
Device selection.
Okay. And this is the one where people start fighting, I think, isn't it? This can be contentious.
It really you know, I think the question is always at this point in education is iOS or something else. I mean, that seems to be the question. You know, you have things like Chromebooks, Windows 8, Windows 8 tablets, you know, the Surface and the ones that Dell and HP makes, the Nexus devices, the Kindle Fire devices, mm-hmm. The Samsung tablets. It always seems to be iOS or something else, and you kind of put everything else in that one camp. And, you know, iOS is certainly, you know, it's crazy to think, but is a new device, you know, the iPad specifically, and it's so dominant in our market at this point. And I'm almost surprised. I was reading a case study, and they were mentioning a Dell laptop program, and that surprised me. I had not read about a Dell laptop program in schools in years, and I'm sure there are many, but it's all we're hearing about now are iOS-based deployments.
Yep. In some ways, though, I think the conversation is a wee bit simpler today than it was maybe 18 months ago or 2 years ago when, you know, Apple came out with the iPad and it stood alone for quite a long time. I mean, people often ask me, why didn't you look at Android when you started? And I said, well, you know, look at what I had at the time. It was the iPad or it was the Dell Streak, which is a 5-inch Android tablet running Android 1.4 or whatever it is. And then what happened was everybody was convinced that, you know, all these new things are going to come out and they're going to kill the iPad. And that was kind of the narrative for the last 6 months of the first year, if you like, the end of 2010, middle of 2011. And it was Amazon bringing out the Kindle Fire. Well, is that going to be a big iPad killer? Is it going to be a serious competitor? Turns out, I mean, I say it's been successful. I mean, nobody knows because Amazon doesn't tell you, but you see a number of Kindle Fires, but they've clearly become a very entertainment-focused product. You know, they're built around accessing the content that you buy or rent from Amazon and also buying more stuff from Amazon, right? And they're not really exactly the kind of thing that you would put in the hands of a schoolchild, for example. And then it was, well, let's just wait to see what Microsoft does about tablets. And then it was, well, is the Surface going to be an iPad killer because it's all about the business? And in fact, you know, it's kind of increasingly looking like Windows 8 and Surface is kind of a bust. And then, of course, you know, it's any day now there's going to be a big Android tablet that's going to just crush the iPad. Hasn't really happened. I mean, you certainly see plenty of those small Android tablets, but in some ways I think that's much as much a function of their cost as anything. And, you know, Ben Baharin, one of our favorite analysts online, he often observes the idea that a lot of these Android tablets are basically sold like televisions. You know, they're like mini portable televisions, and that's what they're used for in large parts of the world. So I think today, you know, the conversation is actually a lot clearer. But in some ways, other things have started to come back in or come in the first place. And you mentioned Chromebooks, Bradley, as one of those things.
Yeah, the Chromebook, I think outside of education, is a flop from what I've read. But inside of our walls, it's a very interesting device because in some ways of the simplicity of it. It's a laptop with a keyboard, but it's also just Chrome. You don't have to deal with like the flux of having Windows on your network and the security involved with that. And they're incredibly inexpensive.
Yes. I think of all the things that are not an iPad, to me, Chrome OS and Chromebooks are by far the most interesting because I kind of regard Android tablets as a wee bit of just a me too product. You know, it's like, okay, you wanted something that was like the iPad, but you wanted to buy something that was cheaper, so you got the Android, okay? And it's not as good. The apps are not as good. But, you know, it's a tablet and you got one, okay? But, you know, in many ways, Android is kind of what you buy if you can't afford the iPad. But with Chrome OS, it's very much a different kind of thing because it's a traditional form factor. You're very traditional laptop and trackpad. Or now, of course, some of the there's sort of desktop boxes coming out as well, providing a certain set of capabilities at a very, very, very low cost. And it's very interesting to me. I'm not saying I'm going to change my school to be a Chromebook school. I'm certainly not going to do that. But I think if your objective is to basically put a kind of replacement Windows and Office laptop in everybody's hands for the lowest possible cost, and Chromebook looks like a really good option to go for.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. And you know, we've talked about when we were talking about Google Drive and the integration there. And you imagine this world where Android didn't exist. And even if you had Chrome OS running on phones, that feels more Googly than Android does.
Yes, it's got the Google DNA in it, doesn't it? You know, it's web. And I kind of like that. I think to me, and you know, I'm always kind of obsessed with like the theoretical side of these things. I'm like, what's the kind of theory of Google Chrome and Chrome OS and things like that? And what is the theory of Android, if you like? The theory of Chrome OS is everything on the web. And Google was born as a web company. The web is their thing. And in so many ways, Android just feels like a real big diversion for Google. And I think it will be very interesting to see whether, you know, which one of these two approaches wins out at the end of the day. Even if even one has to win out, I don't know if they do, but I think you can sort of see a perfectly conceived world inside Chrome OS where you've got Drive, you've got Google Docs on the web, you've got this machine that runs all that stuff, and you know, you can now, of course, buy quite a lot of storage for very, very cheap. And what does that look like? You know, if I don't know about you, Bradley, but if I think about all the things I do with my MacBook Air, I would say most of the week, most of the time, what I'm doing is something in a browser. Obviously, I'm recording the show. I'm using Adobe Audition right now. A couple of other things from time to time, but the majority of the time I spend in my computer is spent in a browser.
Yeah, and even when I'm not, I'm in apps like Evernote and Wunderlist, which have web-based components.
And that's the kind of shape of software now, though, isn't it? It's not just software is an executable binary that you download to your computer and you run it. I mean, some apps are, yes, but I think the apps that we really invest our time and our content in these days are apps that are multiple expressions of some kind of cloud service. So if you think about Dropbox, for example, Dropbox the service, there's Dropbox the app, and then there's Dropbox the API that's integrated into lots of other apps we use. And the same thing with Google Drive or Evernote. You know, Evernote is not just the app that I install on my iPad. Evernote's that plus the service. And it's really the service that we're buying into. And the expression of that service is just one of these apps on one of many platforms. And I think I'm some sort of coming to see my laptop as one client amongst many rather than the hub of what I do in my computing life.
No, I'm in that same boat. It's just amazing how things have changed in even the past 5 years. And
yep,
it'll be, I would like to think things will slow down slightly, but you know, as we see things like wearables and things like that coming out, and we've seen, you know, they have the Evernote app for the Pebble Watch, you see that it's an interesting world we're living in.
Yeah, I think more and more what we're going to see is we're just going to see the ubiquity of these endpoints for cloud services just everywhere. You know, you do something, you can put it into Evernote, you can put it into Google Drive, you can put it into Dropbox or wherever it is you want it to go. And that's going to be possible from your phone, it's going to be possible from your tablet. It's not going to matter what machine you're on until you want to start doing some other things. And I think this is where there comes a fork in the road between looking at a Chromebook and looking at an iOS device, where we can go along together for so long and we can all do the same kind of things. We can all do word processing. We can all do presentations. We can all do spreadsheets. And at some point, iOS does tend to just go beyond what you can do on a Chrome OS device. And I think that's when you start to get into things like iPhoto and iMovie, GarageBand, and things like things that really kind of wrap around the form factor. Let me come back to that, because a couple more things I want to say about Chromebook, though. I mean, let's think about it just for a second. Like, what are the pros and cons of going Chromebook, right? We mentioned the pros already, a traditional form factor, and that it's very low cost. I mean, I don't know what it is in American money, Bradley, but the Chromebook that I've got here on my desk was £190, right? Which is pretty cheap. That's like $5,000 or something, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it a very, you know, in dollars, it really depends on the model you get. But I've seen them on sale for $200.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I'm slightly a wee bit suspicious about Chromebooks is, do you remember when Kindle Fire first came out? And it was just amazingly cheap. And everybody was like, how can we possibly be getting this good a tablet for so cheap? And then as subsequent models came out, every one of them just inched the price up a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. Till now, today, a high-spec Kindle Fire doesn't look like a great deal. You know, okay, it's different from an iPad, but it's not so much cheaper anymore. It's actually reasonably expensive at the top end. So, and I think with the recent wave of Chromebooks that are coming out, that you're starting to see those prices just edge up and edge up and edge up to the point where, I mean, I've got the Samsung, I think it's called the CR2 Chromebook, and it's very, very cheap, but it's also really slow. You know, and when you start to spend a lot of time using Google Drive on a Mac and then try and use your Google Drive on a Chromebook, this Chromebook is just really, really slow. And the newer ones are certainly faster. I mean, it was Asus I was looking at the other day have brought out desktop Chrome machines which have got i3 and i5 processors in them, which is great for performance. But, you know, the price is starting to get up to £300 and £400 for some of those things. So I kind of feel like the first wave of Chromebooks came in, everybody was like, wow, a laptop for £200. And now it's like, well, a laptop that I actually would be quite happy to use every day is more like £400. You know, and that's really starting to edge into Windows laptop territory. So it'll be interesting to see how much better they can get without bumping the price up substantially. And I think I'm starting to see that already a little bit.
Yeah, and you know, it's like I was looking at Synology's, the NAS media servers, mm-hmm. and, you know, like as a Plex server. And so I was looking at, and, you know, if you really want the one that's nice with the bells and whistles, you know, they have some for $300, $200 or $300, but like, then you're thinking, well, the nice one's $550. Mm. The really nice one is like $650. And then as you get closer and closer, you get to like, I could just buy a Mac Mini for not a lot more.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's one of the kind of possible cons of Chromebook is that the cheapest one is very cheap, and that gets the conversation started. But the one you may actually be happy to deploy to everybody is actually a wee bit more money than that. I also, you know, based on my Samsung Chromebook experience, which I know is not the latest Chromebook, I have a certain question about its robustness. You know, it is made of very cheap plastic, and its reliability. You know, parts like the hinge and things like that, and the keyboard, and the, particularly the trackpad, is not in great shape. And I've not used that Chromebook very much. It's only about 6 or 8 months old. I suppose at one level you could say, well, how do I get that repaired, and how do I get it, you know, who's going to look after me once I've bought it? But at another level, like, who cares, right? It's only £200. You know,
yeah.
If I break an iPad, I'm paying £250 for a repair to an iPad. If I was buying Chromebooks, I'd just throw that one in the bin and get another one.
Yeah, and you just get that device that cheap, you plan for a higher damage rate.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe that's actually not, you know, you got to take a long-term and quite a kind of grown-up view in some of this stuff. It's not like, too often I see schools take the approach that any damage is a disaster, you know, and damage should never happen. So they defend their iPads with massive cases and so on. And I think, you know, we've advocated in this show before, Bradley, and I think we're right, that plan that some will break, right? And just structure everything so that that's okay when it does happen, right? Because it's inevitable. It's a fact of life. So maybe the way to look at Chromebook is it's just a disposable computer.
Well, you think about if you're a company that has company cars, do you put, I mean, how do you protect them? You don't. You have insurance on them, or, you know, you get out and drive, or maybe you, if your state allows it, you self-insure, and mm-hmm. you just get out and drive, and if you have problems, you pay for the repairs. It's just almost the cost of doing business. If you spend so much trying to prevent problems, you just, you know, you spend more money.
Yeah, definitely. From an educational point of view, though, one of my concerns about Chromebook is that, like you said, Bradley, outside of education, Chromebook is essentially non-existent. You know, it seems, and my slight concern is that using Chromebooks as the kind of majority thing in your school might be a bit of an evolutionary dead end. You know, you can make a perfectly hermetically sealed world inside your school where everything's consistent and we all use Google Drive and we all use Google Docs and we all use all this stuff. And then when people step out into the real world, nobody's got a Chromebook and nobody's heard of Chrome. You know, that could happen. Maybe not. If you get compelling enough, maybe not. But I think that was an argument that was leveled against iPad back in the day. But I think today, if you just walk around any business, go to the supermarket, go to the airport, you'll see people doing all kinds of business on iPad now. And I think having iPad skills when you leave school is actually something that in today's world is actually quite a reasonable thing to have, because the chances of you being handed some kind of tablet computer to work on are pretty reasonable. You know, they're starting to really come in a lot of businesses. Now, you could make by the extension of that argument, you could say that the majority of us should all be using Windows. But I think you got to just take a wee, sometimes take a guess, sometimes take a gamble. But I think more often than not, we're going to start to see these non-Windows things. I don't know if Chromebooks are going to make it as a big mainstream business tool or even consumer tool, never mind business, because it's not always about business and education. We're not just doing education in order to produce the next generation of cubicle fodder for businesses. That's not why I got into it, and I'm pretty sure that's not why most teachers go into either. But I think it's just something to be aware of, that I would like to see a wee bit more traction for Chrome OS outside of education to make school more like the real world. I mean, that was my, that's always my kind of mantra. School should be a bit like the real world. And it would be nice to see Chrome OS take off a little bit more. But maybe it'll come. Maybe it'll come.
Yes, yes.
So now that we're turning this into the Chrome OS show. I think there are good reasons for Chrome OS to be popular in education. Whether those reasons are all about the student themselves or whether some of them are about the cost of administration in the school, I'm not sure. But I think it's something definitely to weigh up. And I think I don't know if you've been to schools like this, Bradley, but I've seen some schools where they have iPad all the way up till they do the exams and then they have Chromebook because the exams are all about essays. And I think that's a view that I have more and more sympathy with. I think it's quite an interesting idea, given that exams are what they are. So definitely keep an eye on it. One thing to think about with Chrome OS, though, is that you have this management system built into Google Apps, and that's not free. You can may get the impression that it's free, but it's actually not. And my understanding of it is that you have to, if you want to buy Chromebooks and bring them into your school's Google Apps, you have to buy them through Google's official sales channels and then pay. I think it's £20 per £20 per device for 3 years to manage that device. So it's comparable on a yearly basis to putting an iOS device into an MDM service. But just bear in mind that it is not free.
Yeah, we had a school on a few months ago that had actually done I believe it was a Nexus deployment, and so and it was interesting to hear their kind of take on the Google Life with education. So we'll have a link to that show in the show notes this week at outofschool.net.
Yes, I believe that was referred to as our Nixon Goes to China episode. What about something like Surface?
My concern overall with Surface today is that if you go into it with a 3 to 4 year deployment in mind, that Microsoft's vision may change midway through it. You know, because even if, you know, we can talk about the office world of having things locally and that not be the way of the future, there are things about the Surface device that are appealing in some ways. But my big concern with the perceived failure of Windows 8, certainly the perceived failure of Surface RT,
yes,
in terms of sales and reviews, with a new CEO, that in 18 months that device may not even be sold.
I think there's a reasonable prospect that that could happen. It would be massively embarrassing for Microsoft, but I think you're absolutely right about Surface RT. The Surface RT is just a strategy that nobody understood from the get-go and nobody wanted. It's a product nobody wanted, right? It's something that looks exactly like Windows but doesn't work like Windows. And it was confusing even to, you know, reasonably experienced technologists as well. So, yep, Surface specifically is probably, I mean, if you look at what's happening with like the price of the Intel power surfaces, the actual full power surface, they're quite expensive compared to iPads. They're actually, I think in some cases, they're more expensive than an iPad for similar storage levels. But yeah, the overriding thing, I think, Bradley, is just the general perception of failure that is around Windows 8. You know, it's just not something that people are really keen on, as far as we can tell. And Windows Phone is doing nothing for that either. You know, no. Windows Phone is essentially just nowhere. It's over.
And I don't... I used to be kind of a Microsoft basher, maybe back in the 2007, 2008 days, and you kind of... The evil empire. But that's not Microsoft anymore. And there are things about Microsoft that they do that are really nice. Like SkyDrive is not a bad thing. Like it actually works fairly well. And they've got some neat ideas inside of their new phones. And again, give them some props for trying something new with Surface, you know, not just building an iPad competitor. So I'm certainly not rooting against them, but I'm not betting on them at this point.
Yeah, I think people were betting on Microsoft for a while. I mean, I know I had conversations in, you know, 2010 and 2011 where people more or less explicitly said to me, look, we're just stalling this iPad thing until Microsoft get their tablet out. And then we'll see. Then the gloves will be off and that will be, you know, Apple will be getting punched around. And in fact, it just hasn't happened. I mean, I think it's fair to say it probably just hasn't happened. So Microsoft's not going away. We're not saying it's over for Microsoft. But at the same time, they're not really leading what's happening in the industry anymore, at least in the kind of area that we're talking about here.
You know, the question remains, is Microsoft where Apple is in, say, 97 when Steve came back? Or is Microsoft... is the Surface the Dreamcast? And it was their last big hurrah as an OS and hardware manufacturer. And again, I'm not saying Windows is going away anytime soon, but is Microsoft's future more like Sega?
Mm-hmm.
Where they can, you know, Microsoft and Office is synonymous. Because if you look at Office 365, it's really nice. And, there are things about it that aren't perfect, but it's not terrible. And certainly if you have organizations that are, you know, Microsoft shops and they're gung-ho about it and it can integrate in with Active Directory, it can be appealing to some people. And so is Microsoft, you know, the Sega of our industry, or is it Atari and they just disappear slowly?
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about when we have documentaries about them. You know, I don't know. I'm not saying it's happening in the next 10 years, but 50 years from now, is Microsoft still around?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true, right, that many, many schools and school districts are still very, very Microsoft-centric. And that's not something you easily change because everybody's trained in it. Everybody's, all the techs are certified in Microsoft stuff. They're all MCSP or whatever. And that's not something you change overnight. And it's not a culture. It's not an attitude that you can change overnight. But I think... in this move to mobile devices and MDM systems and things like that, what I think we're starting to see is that there are some things in systems administration that you just don't need to do anymore. And it's not just that there's no way to implement Active Directory login on an iPad, therefore it can't possibly be considered. But I think what you have to do is you have to start thinking, well, do we actually need to have Active Directory login system at all? And we've decommissioned our Mac login system. And we're just using Mac standalone on an ad hoc basis as we need to. Because the numbers are so small and the usage is so infrequent, who cares? Well, but that's a hard thing for people to let go of. You know, how will we ever get by without our login system? Well, if you're going to go to something like personal devices, then, you know, why are you going to ask them to log into the device that's exclusively theirs, right? So as computers become more ubiquitous, these big, big infrastructures for making computers easily and safely shareable sort of dwindle in their importance over time, I think. But I think one of the things, the point I want to make about this, Bradley, is that although we have always argued that consistency in the basic operating system and platform that you use in the school is quite important because it gives people a shared culture and a shared sense of something that we all understand and we can all work together with, I think it's fair to say that we've never looked at it in terms of if you bring in iOS, then iOS is the only platform anybody in the school gets to use for any purpose. Is that a fair assumption of what you feel as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Because one of the things that you often get when you walk into school is thinking about an iPad deployment on a big scale is those teachers who have got an invested workflow in, say, Windows devices, they're very concerned that that's going to be taken away from them. So examples always include things like the art department who've got all the Adobe Suite set up. And they're like, well, if iPads come in, how can we run our Adobe Suite? Well, the answer is you probably don't have to, but think about all the other teachers in the school who don't have any computers. What about them? Or you go to somewhere like the technical department and they're doing CAD/CAM modeling, for example. And it's, how am I going to do CAD/CAM modeling on the iPad? Well, keep your CAD/CAM tools, but think about the other 80% of the school that doesn't have any computers. What about them? Sometimes the music department have special things. If you teach film and TV studies or things like that, you may need higher end tools than the iPad can provide. But the point is always that if there's one basic thing, you can start to add on additional platforms as required for certain things. Sorry, go ahead.
I think my mantra is always the best tool for the job. And for so long, you know, a Dell laptop was overkill for what we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the iPad came along. It was the right tool for the job. And so, yeah, don't try to shoehorn iOS into every aspect of your school if it doesn't make sense. You know, does your financial, does your CFO need to run an iPad day to day? Maybe they need a laptop with a big external monitor. I mean, you know, it's, yeah, it's just you pick the right tool for the job. And it doesn't have to be, you know, obviously, again, we talk about the simplicity of baseline, but don't be so held to that that you can't make exceptions where it needs to be held. Again, I don't like my student management system. I couldn't manage that from an iPad today. I would love to. That would be awesome, but I can't. Mm-hmm. So day to day, I have to set it a Mac for that reason.
Yeah, but I think sometimes right tool for the job can lead you down equally squirrely holes, if you like. Because if you are very, very focused on the right tool for the job in every possible scenario, then you just end up having one of everything kicking about. And I think you've got to make a call that says, this is the best tool for most of the jobs, so that's the one everybody gets. And then if you have particularly specialized requirements, you know, you can get this, this, and this. But I think what you're looking for is you're looking for a computer where most teachers can do everything they want to do with just that one computer. And to me, that's iPad right now. Not saying it's always that way, but right now I'm looking at that as being the computer that most people can use for almost everything they want to do. And that includes things like video editing and audio production and photography and all these different applications. And then on top of that, you know, if we're doing, I don't know, computer science, we're teaching computer programming, maybe we need a more powerful computer for that. Or if this course that we're teaching is specifically about Microsoft Office, we need a different kind of computer for that. But you don't want to end up with just having, you know, a massive library of all these different kinds of computers, and then we just have to use every different one for the very specific job.
Oh yeah, I agree. That your baseline device needs to be the rule, not your exceptions need to be far and few between. And of course, in a lot of situations, if the iPad isn't the tool that they can use, so let's talk about AutoCAD for a second. Mm-hmm. My sister-in-law uses AutoCAD for her job. She's a landscape architect. And so I see her, you know, she uses AutoCAD day to day. And I see her working and I think, this is where like a big screen iPad would be an incredible tool for her. Mm-hmm. If she could use her finger to do what she's doing, and it could, you know, she's designing landscapes for, you know, hotels and things like that. And to me, it would be so much, you know, faster and smoother to be able to drag that with your finger rather than click and, you know, drag things around with a, mm-hmm. you know, with a trackpad. But again, it's not the device there that fails her. It's the applications.
Yeah. Yeah, the device is powerful enough. It's just that I think the interaction of like the user interface and the size of the screen hasn't quite fit together yet. And if you look at a lot of the audio production tools on iOS, what you find is that a lot of them, like Cubasis and Aria, we've talked about them in the past on the show, what they've done is they've taken desktop audio workstation ideas and they've brought them directly to the iPad. So, for example, if you want to split a track in one of those tools, you tap on the timeline where you want to split the track, and then you tap on a menu and you tap split track. Whereas if you had a more gestural feel to it, you could just, you know, maybe tap the track and then swipe across it to split it or something like that. But none of those tools actually support that yet, so they have taken the basic idea of the application and brought it onto the iPad, but they haven't sort of rethought the interaction model for a world that's gestural and touchscreen just yet. And I think that's an interesting area of development for the future, perhaps.
Yeah, certainly again, these pro-level tools, these workflows are so ingrained. And so companies, when they're building these, they try to be familiar, build these familiar workflows. But you almost think if someone would take a big chance and get on audio editing, it's like, okay, let's try to rethink audio editing for the handheld touch-based devices. What does that look like? And throw out everything we know about user interface with audio programs.
Mm-hmm. Interesting for the future.
Well, and I think you make a great point. Yet it's the device. We were waiting for things to catch up. And it's not that they won't ever be there. It's not that we won't ever have an AutoCAD for iOS. It's just not available yet.
Indeed. So let's have a little dig into, for the sake of argument, let's say we are going to go iOS, because that just seems to be what most people are doing in education right now. There are people doing Android. There are people doing Chromebook. But I think it's probably fair to say that the majority of things are not Windows computers in schools today are iOS devices. Does that seem like a fair assumption?
Absolutely. I think most of our listeners know we would come to that conclusion, and most of them would probably agree with us.
I think so. And always and forever, the thing about educational technology is you have to think about what is the right thing for now, not what is the right thing in 5 years' time. Because, that's half a pupil's school life gone if you sit and wait 5 years before you do something. So it's like, the next question we're going to talk about is, well, what iPad do you buy? The answer is you buy the one that's on sale when you open the school for that year, right? You can't wait half the school year to get the next device. You've got to ship on the opening day. So let's talk a little bit about hardware factors on an iOS deployment. What are we going to talk about?
First thing is size, size of storage. Do you go 16, 32, 64, 128? And this is one area I think Apple has some work to do. Mm-hmm. I would really like to see 16 go away on definitely the iPad, but certainly the iPhone as well. And I would like to see 32 at the 16 gig price. And the iPad has been the same storage since it came out. I know the original iPhone started at 4 gigs, mm-hmm. so it's gone up a little bit. But cost of storage is coming down, and I know people people listen to us probably carry 32 gig versions of both of those devices, if not bigger. And I know those things really help out Apple's margins, because I imagine that a 32 gig device probably cost about $3 more to make than a 16 gig. I'm just guessing, but it's got to be nothing at this point.
Yep.
And but I think you've got to consider, don't just consider, what on day one after you install your apps, how much space do you have left, but what kind of data will your students make over the life of your lease? Not necessarily, the first quarter or the first year, but the life of your lease.
Yep. So let me give you some numbers in this, Bradley, because we deployed, when we got our new devices last summer, we went from 16 in the first iteration of the deployment to 32 gigs this time. And what I have in my Casper is four smart groups for devices which are less than 25% full, devices between 25 and 50% full, 50 to 75% full, and more than 75% full. And think that's 75% or 25% of a 3 gigabyte, sorry, a 32 gigabyte storage capacity. So let me give you the numbers here. I have got about 15% of the devices are less than 25% full, which probably corresponds to the first couple of years of the school. 60% of the devices are between 25 and 50% full. Now 30%, 29% are between 50 and 75% full, and only less than 10% are more than 75% full. So we're not seeing a lot of people immediately filling up a 32 gig iPad. We're seeing most of them hover, the majority, just about three quarters, are less than 50% full after 1 year's worth of work. And that includes, of course, includes apps and storage. But what I do see is that I have email notifications for all these groups when devices come in, go across those boundaries. I get an email about it. And what I see is that sometimes kids will spike right up into that 75% full category and then drop down again. And what I know when I see that is that that class teacher just did a video project, because the kids will burst up into that, you know, they eat up a ton of storage in the device. Then when they edit it all down and export the video, get rid of the original footage, the device will drop back down into that steady state where it's under 50% full. So my feeling right now is that for most purposes, 32 is probably a good school number right now.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it'll be really neat to see if that changes, you know, in year two and year three of your lease, mm-hmm. or if that kind of stays the same as they, you know, export things off and maybe they don't keep stuff long term. It'll be, you know, watching that will be interesting to see.
Yeah. My intention is not to recall the devices this summer and wipe them and start again. So I'm going to try and see what will happen, because obviously nowadays we also have Google Drive going alongside. So we've got that ability to offload big chunks of data off to a cloud service and reclaim storage space on the device as well. And if you have the ability to run both of these things in parallel, then you probably don't need a 64 or 128 gig iPad unless you really have some very clear and worked out reason why you do need something of that size right now.
Yeah, so, and it, you know, I'm really, you know, it'll be neat to see what happens, you know, our next lease. Will 64, you know, be the standard? Maybe Apple will surprise us. I don't know. We can hope.
We can hope. Next thing to talk about, which device? Is it going to be iPad mini or is it going to be full size? Or are we going to go for the older one to save money?
My advice is to not buy the oldest one. Is always buy the newest one, you know, possible. You know, don't try to save, you know, $100 here and there, because that may work year one. You know, again, we got the iPad 2 still out. That mm-hmm. may look great year one, but you're going to feel it in year two.
Yeah, and you're going to really hate yourself in year three. I think, you know, think about an iPad 2, right? It's a really slow iPad now. And the kind of ways that we're pushing iPads into things like, I mean, imagine trying to use iMovie on an iPad 2, for example. I think that would be a pretty unpleasant experience. You do always have to think about the fact that you are buying for 3 years from now as well. And that was what motivated our decision to go for the full-size Retina iPad rather than the as-was iPad mini. It was partly because at the time, the iPad mini was half the speed of the full-size iPad. Now, happily, that's no longer true. And the Retina iPad mini and the full-size iPad Air are essentially the same thing inside. And it's just a matter of what size you want to get.
And then don't forget about AirDrop not being available on the iPad 2 either.
That's a huge thing. I think the disappointment that people experience when they don't get to use AirDrop in the classroom is pretty painful. I cannot describe to you how important AirDrop is in the classroom. It's particularly if you are constrained for Wi-Fi or bandwidth, having that capability of moving data around the classroom without a network is an absolute godsend. And I think that would be another major decision factor in going for something newer than iPad 2. I mean, any generation of iPad mini will do AirDrop, but also the full-size iPad Air as well.
You know, and you know, we're looking at screen size that we've mentioned countless times before, depending on what kind, if you're doing a dual deployment with a laptop, again, at maybe the mini, but I believe, you know, feel like you that if you're going one-to-one with iOS, that the full size is the way to go.
Yeah. We thought about splitting our deployment between mini and full size, but because the proportion, any boundary that we put on that, such as, you know, iPad mini for the primary kids and full size for the secondary kids, the number of kids in either side of that boundary fluctuates from year to year. So you'd end up having to have, you know, one lease set for the primary and one lease set for the secondary and manage those. You're essentially doing more work again. So we decided there's just going to be one device for everybody and it's going to be the full size. Well, and I'm personally not convinced. Sorry, brother. I was just going to say, I'm not convinced that the iPad mini is better for young children. I think it's intuitively true because you think small people, small iPad makes sense. But my contention has been ever since I saw young children using iPad mini that you need better motor skills because the iPad mini has no real software modifications to make it easier to hit targets on the smaller screen with the smaller physical size. You need better motor skills to use an iPad mini than you do to use a full-size iPad. And if you think about young children, they have poorer motor skills than we do. So they actually have bigger, chunkier, fatter things in all respects than we do. So I reckon it's as appropriate to put a full-size iPad in a young child's hands as it is to put it into a 15- or 16-year-old's hands as well.
And, you know, thinking too, with if you're having spares, if you say, okay, we're going to have, I'm buying 100 iPads, I'm going to have 5 spares.
Yep.
If you start to split your deployment, then, you know, how do you calculate those? You know, how do you have spares of what and how do you distribute those?
Yeah, you essentially have to increase your stock of spares to cover more than one part type in the school. Yep. Any thoughts on color?
I don't care. Black, whatever.
Any color you like as long as it's black or white. Right?
Yes. Or maybe we'll get the gold iPad.
No.
Ooh, good thing you didn't have to make that decision. The girls would love it.
Well, we actually put our color choice to vote in the school, and the overwhelming demand was for the white iPad. So all our iPads this year are white. And it was like 75% in favor of white. It was enormous. And I don't know if that was just because they wanted a change from the black ones that we had before, but we got the white ones and, you know, they're fine. You know, there's no reason not to go white if you like it. In some ways, white, I think, looks a little bit better with iOS 7, but that's a very minor factor. Doesn't seem to get any dirtier, I have to say. You'd think white gets dirty, but cleans up as much as a black one ever did, I think. So that's hardware, right?
Well, one thing we didn't mention, the sadness that the iPad release date is now in the fall. It really worked out well for schools that when it was in March.
Mm-hmm. March was perfect. Bring back March. But everything's out for Christmas now is the thing, you know. What can you say? You've got to, like I said at the start of this little segment, you've got to buy whatever's current when you open the doors, you know. That's why we ended up, you know, we were like 3 months ahead of the iPad Air. If we had been able to wait 3 months, which we couldn't, we could have got the iPad Air. But it is what it is. You know, I mean, maybe in general, though, the future is we do our redeployments Christmas to Christmas, you know, or February to February or something like that, rather than summer to summer. I don't know. It's probably too much work in any of these shorter holidays to get that turned around for a big school, but we could maybe pull it off at small scale in a two-week holiday.
Well, and you know, a lot will depend on how the hardware advances and the pace it continues to advance. I mean, obviously the iPad Air was huge. Mm-hmm. And so if you had, say, deployed iPad 3 and then iPad 4 came out when school started, I mean, iPad 4 was faster, absolutely, but it didn't seem like it was the jump from 3 to 4 that was 4 to Air.
Yeah, the jump to 64-bit and the doubling again of the performance and the increased radio performance as well, it was a pretty big deal for iPad Air. So lucky schools who are buying now.
Yes.
That's all I can say. What about software factors when you consider an iOS deployment, Bradley?
You know, I've had this thought running through my head. You know, we've got these new tools from Apple, the device enrollment program and all that goes along with that. And I'm lumping in MDM, you know, VPP, all that in there. Mm-hmm. And it seems like what Apple's doing is building a moat around iOS's dominance in education, and I guess you should say the enterprise as well. Mm-hmm. And it's, to me, it's very similar to what Microsoft did with Exchange and Active Directory. And so, you know, when people wanted to bring their Macs to work or their Linux computers to work and they wanted to use these, it's like, well, it's got to support Exchange and Active Directory. That's what we use. That's our infrastructure. And those mm-hmm. are our locks. And so if your key doesn't fit that lock, you can't use it. And so as iOS deployments continue to grow and Apple has kind of their hooks more in them and they're not necessarily as interchangeable, you know, even if the apps you use are, you know, cross-platform, but your back-end management systems are built around iOS, it's not going to be as easy to change even when your lease is up. And so Apple's basically doing what Microsoft did and controlling the locks to the kingdom.
Yes, I think my contention has always been with Microsoft that they knew who their customer was, and it wasn't the end user of the computer. They were always much better at selling to the IT people than they were to the people who had to sit there and use these computers. And I think Apple's, to my delight, starting to kind of cater to that same mentality, is putting it too negatively, but that organizational dynamic that you have to make life easy for the people who have to deploy these at large scale. Because if you want to roll out 50,000 to a company, you're going to have to get the IT people on board and not antagonize them. And I think things like device enrollment and managed distribution and MDM and so on are starting to, you know, more than throw a bone to these people, but actually, you know, genuinely give them tools that will make these deployments work and work right at large scale. So I think one of the things I try to get across to people who come and visit us, for example, is that it's often people who maybe have their own iPad and they sort of are still a wee bit in the mindset that, well, I did that and that was quite easy. So therefore, 1,000 times that is just that amount of effort times 1,000. Whereas, in fact, there's actually, I think, an increasingly well-established body of knowledge about how to professionally design and deploy an iOS deployment that includes understanding your Wi-Fi capabilities, having a strategy for device enrollment and supervision, and somebody who knows about designing restriction profiles, and having somebody who knows about MDM, and having devices enrolled in MDM and enforcing that, and all of these things. There's a sort of stack of software and management technologies now that simply didn't exist 3 years ago or 4 years ago. I mean, when I started, my stack of management technologies was iTunes and iTunes Home Sharing. I'm not even kidding. That was all we had, right? And that was how we did our deployment. And today you've got all these different moving parts. Very, very powerful machinery, but you've got to know how to put them all together to achieve the result you want. Those are the things you have to consider. Like I said, with Chromebooks, you've got to think about the management fee. That's not zero. Same with iOS. How much does it cost to put in an MDM server? How much does it cost to... Obviously, device enrollment's free and volume purchase, at least the managed distribution part, is free. The apps aren't free. But how does that all work together to bring out an iOS deployment up to scratch in a large-scale environment like a school?
I'm really surprised that Apple's not released some sort of certification for this. And maybe they will now that they've had all these pieces come out. Because, again, like you said, it used to be about just understanding how to sync with iTunes. Yep. And now, and it's not that they're complicated pieces of the puzzle, but you want to have like a 40,000-foot view of how an iOS deployment works and what controls what. Because, again, like we said, if you mess up on the front end, it takes a while to recover from it.
Yeah. And it's not that they're... These are particularly difficult tools to use. They're just philosophically different. You know, it never used to be that you would intermingle your imaging technology with the vendor's cloud services, right? You would always have that imaging technology in-house, whether it was on OS X or Windows technology. But nowadays, we're seeing, well, this device enrollment program, we're putting some of our configuration into Apple servers, and then the machine is talking to Apple first, and then it talks to us. How can we manage all that stuff? You know, it's just there's a change of mindset, and the design is different, and the world's changed, I guess, is what I'm saying. And I think this all feeds in together that I think you're absolutely right, Bradley, that certification for IT professionals would be a massive step towards gaining a bit more confidence and trust in that area of education than the Apple currently has. And I think it's coming. When I say it's coming, what I mean is the trust is coming. I don't mean that an iOS certification, IT certification is coming, because I don't know if that's true or not, although I do agree with you that it absolutely should. But if you think about how does an IT professional move their career forward? Well, one of the ways they move their career forward is to get certifications. And that enables them to become more senior, argue for higher salaries, negotiate those things up. And Apple at the moment doesn't have really anything like that. And I think it would be really, really powerful if they did.
Yeah, yep. We shall see. They've done a lot in the past early 12 months for us with these big, you know, especially the larger deployments. It has changed drastically.
Yep, I think the last thing to talk about in terms of like the software factors you might consider when doing an iOS deployment, and we've talked about it again, but something, if I can give it a general name, something like long-term nearline storage for your iOS device. And that's kind of a fancy way of saying something like Dropbox or Google Drive in the case of our school, or some kind of on-site web dev server, or something where you can basically take completed, finished work that may be, you know, large in data size and take it off your iPad and onto some other thing where it doesn't have to eat storage on the iPad as well. And iCloud is absolutely not that service. iCloud, that's not what iCloud is for. It's what Google Drive is for. It's what Dropbox is for. It's what Box is for. And I think thinking about, you don't need it on the first day, but thinking about it as something that, you know, possibly even as far away as 3 years from now, we're going to need something where our students can take data off their iPad and put it onto some external server. Planning for something like that is going to be an important part of your deployment too.
I agree. I think it's, we talked about Google Drive and Dropbox at the beginning of the show. I've heard Box is preparing for an IPO. There's a reason these companies are doing so well, because this problem exists.
Yes, it does. It does. And I think it kind of speaks to the way that our devices are becoming, they're becoming clients for the cloud. Because if you think about, you know, you can't store the entire Google index of the web on your iPad. But you can still search the web with it as long as you've got a network connection. You can't store all the data you might ever want on your iPad, but you can, or even your laptop for that matter, but you can if they have connections to your Google Drive with a terabyte for what was it, you know, £10 a month or something. That's a lot of storage that you can connect to very quickly and very closely if you have a decent network connection. And again, we come back to the fundamentals of preparation for this. Your network connection has got to be super solid, as always.
Yeah, specifically my phone is like a cloud remote. It's just crazy that the things it can do with an LTE connection anywhere in the world. It blows my mind.
It absolutely does. I completely agree with that in terms of the way I use my phone as well, is that almost everything on there is either a viewer or a controller for something that actually works fundamentally in the cloud. The only perhaps exception to that would be the camera function, where you're actually, a substantial chunk of data is being saved locally and not necessarily synced transparently anywhere else, unless you adopt one of these other technologies like Google Drive, or specifically Dropbox have pushed really hard into that with their automatic camera upload feature as well. So, anything else to talk about? A couple of organizational factors, just really briefly. If you're going to do an iOS deployment, there's two other things you've got to think about, as well as the hardware and the device selection. Be aware that, you know, when you buy a device these days, whether it is whether it's an Android tablet or a Chrome OS device or an iOS device or even a Windows 8 computer, you're not only buying into hardware and an operating system, you're also buying into cloud services and probably account infrastructures as well. And I think that, you know, when we teach about, you know, what are the constituent parts of an operating system? You've got like hardware in the lowest level, and then the kernel, and then the, you know, the APIs, and then the user interface, and then the apps. And traditionally, the diagram sort of stops there. But I think today we should also be seeing, and on top of that, app stores, and on top of that, cloud storage services, and on top of that, account infrastructure. Because if you think about it, you know, this is one of the arguments for going single platform. And it's not an argument for any specific platform, but the fact that you've got your Microsoft account, SkyDrive, Office 365 on top of Windows 8 is actually a reasonably consistent software stack. And with Apple, you know, you've got App Store, Apple ID, things like iTunes U and services on top of iOS, on top of iOS hardware, is a pretty consistent software stack as well. And I thought Google were going to go that way as well, because you could see, you know, Google services obviously were always great at the start, and then you've got Android, then you've got Android hardware. And I thought that was all going to sort of become vertical. But as we spoke about in previous shows, Bradley, Google have brought almost all of that onto iOS as well. So that if you want the Google Cloud Services stack, it doesn't actually matter that much whether you're buying iOS or Android. You're going to get access to almost all of that on almost an exactly equivalent level. There's still a couple of things that Android's better at in interacting with Google services, but the number of those things is way, way down from what it used to be just a couple of years ago.
And I think I've read articles where Google Drive on iOS, in some ways, is better than Google Drive, the app, on Android.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think you got to look at really Amazon and Google's play here is, you know, if you don't use Apple devices, Apple loses. But if you use Apple devices and Google and Amazon services, everybody wins.
Yep. And it's clear that they know that as well.
And in some ways, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you can have the hardware you want, but then pick the apps that you want.
And the services on top. And when you look at Google Drive and how cheap it's just become, you know, suddenly that's a pretty compelling stack. And as long as we have access to it through apps on iOS, it's great.
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, Google Drive, you know, what I play with today, I've been using it more and more, but you know, it may become like my cloud photo viewer. You know, mm-hmm. I may, I don't know, maybe because it's a lot cheaper than Loom and Picture Life and Dropbox and all that. Maybe I start using that. I don't know.
Could be. So I think have we covered pretty much everything we want to talk about?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this is one of those I'm sure our listeners knew this was going iOS. My advice to people is to continually stay on top of what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, if you have some extra training money, maybe spend that buying a Chromebook and just tinker around with it. Mm-hmm. Even if it gives you ideas for workflows on iOS through Google Drive, you know, one of the things we always get questioned about when it comes to lease time is why aren't we looking at this? Why aren't we looking at that? And we have to answer those questions to our school board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they ask us tough questions, and you need to have, you know, this is one of those shows where you get the reasons for choosing what you choose. You're not choosing iOS because that's the hit thing. You're choosing it because of X, Y, and Z, and it allows us to do this to accomplish our goals. And it does it better these ways.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that this show and this topic in particular is one that people want to dance around all the time. And what the phrase that you'll hear all the time is, oh, it's not about the technology. It's about the learning. And yes, of course it is. But at some point, you've got to choose what you're going to buy, right? And if you just say, well, it's all about the learning, then a good teacher who's into technology can demonstrate effective learning from any technology. But the question is, can every teacher do that? Or do they need more support from a more consistent, managed, organized distribution of technology across the school? And I think using phrases like it's not about the technology as a way to kind of avoid having to make a decision about which technology it's going to be is, I think, a little bit weak. And in some ways, we should have more disagreements in EdTech than we actually do. We should sit down and we should say, well, you know, I went iOS. Here are all my reasons for why I did that. I can give you them chapter and verse. At the same time, I can recognize there are some things in other platforms that might be better. But on the balance of everything, we're going to go iOS. Or if you're going Chromebook, you're saying, well, I can see that, you know, assessment in upper secondary is always going to be text and essay based. therefore we need something in a traditional form factor, and we're just going to use Google Docs, and that's how we're going to do the whole thing. That's a judgment call. But, you know, the thing that people need to do is they need to make a decision, and they need to stand behind it with good, solid technical and educational justifications for the choice they made. And whether that's iOS or whether that's something else, up to you. The answers are different for every school. But just saying, well, it's not about the technology, let's just get whatever is cheapest, easiest, most familiar, I beg you, please think a little bit harder about that. Here endeth the lesson.
I think there's no better way to leave the show than with that quote.
Okay. Well, let us leave it there indeed. This has been week 5 of 15. That's us a third of the way through everything we've planned. We've had some great feedback. I think I would love to hear more feedback. If there's things people want to hear about that we're not talking about yet, or we should do some more follow-up as time goes on, just let us know. We'd love for you to review the show in iTunes. Give us a rating if you can find the time to do that. We'd love that too. You can find the show and the show notes at outschool.net. I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web. Bradley, where can people find you?
On Twitter at Bradley Chambers and at chambersdaily.com on the web. And I want to, again, say thank you to our sponsor this week, Jamp Software. And if you're looking for a product to allow widespread use of Apple technologies in your organization, give them a look at jampsoftware.com, jamfsoftware.com.
Okay, we'll talk to everybody next week.